This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. My guest today is the folk poet, spoken word artist, and queer activist Alex Olson, who I had on the show once before, and I was so knocked over I wanted to get her back on again. Alex Olson's two CDs are Built Like That and Independence Meal, and her work has been featured in a lot of places, including on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam. She's also the co-editor of Burning Down the House and the editor of Word Warriors, 35 Women Leaders and the Spoken Word Revolution. Alex Olson, welcome back to Progressive Radio.
Thank you for having me, Matt.
How have you been?
I've been doing very well.
You've been busy?
I have. I just got back from a week in San Francisco interviewing the Code Pink folks.
And what are you doing with that?
I will be doing the first history slash herstory of Code Pink since its 2002 inception.
Hmm. No one's written a book on Code Pink before.
Code Pink has written a book about itself, but I felt, as somebody who's sort of an outside observer and also a big fan of them, that they needed something that really just makes them look as incredibly amazing as they are.
And what impresses you about them?
You know, I think it's the equal parts commitment to pacifism, to ending the wars, hopefully, the ones that are coming, and their levity. There's something, I think, about the kind of creative spirit they bring to protest that allows us to not just demonstrate and remonstrate, but also just feel good while we're doing it.
It's a kind of a fun combination of hippie and feminism rolled into one there, or
yeah.
Yippie kind of thing.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, the founders do not identify it as a feminist group. So that's something that I would like to explore more too, what it means to be pro-women and run by women with, you know, women positive men in the group, but not necessarily a feminist group.
Why don't they identify it that way?
Well, I'm not sure. I haven't explored that yet, but that will be chapter number one.
And what made you move into book writing as part? Because usually you're just traveling around the country at 100 shows a year or something or more.
Yeah, I was on the road over 200 days a year, and I got old. And, you know, I'm going to grad school. I'm getting a PhD in political science now. And so I felt like there's that part of my intellect that I've ignored for a long time that feels very necessary to my personal development right now.
And are you still going to be doing shows, though?
Yeah. Yeah.
So your fan base is not going to be disappointed. They'll still be able to see you.
Hopefully not. Yeah.
On your website, you say, "I've never been intimidated by words because they've always been on my side."
Oh, did I say that? Oh, no.
What do you mean by that? It's a nice line.
I think that words are crucial. Well, number one, I'm a pacifist, and so words are pretty much the only vehicle that I have for protesting what I believe. And I think that words are often taken for granted, and people are, especially those in power, especially the last 8 years of administration, I think have taken advantage of the power of words, and it's time to reclaim them.
But words can also be tools of propagandists, as you were alluding to, mm-hmm. and also of bullies. But you weren't allowing yourself to be victimized by words in that way. What gave you the sense that you could stand up to ugly words?
I took them back. I think reclamation is incredibly sexy, and I think that the progressive movement has been lacking in its sex appeal, for lack of a better phrase. And I think that utilizing words in a way that is sexy is what's happening right now. I mean, look at Obama. It's one of his, it's at least one of his positive qualities.
Are there particular words you wanted to reclaim?
Yeah, and a lot of them are words I cannot say on the radio at this juncture.
And by reclaiming them, you defuse them.
I believe so. Yeah, actually, one of the book that I edited that you mentioned, Word Warriors, one of the women, Sarah Jones, she was one of the first artists to launch a lawsuit against the FCC for not allowing her to use particular words on the radio, and they were not even the seven words that are considered, you know, nasty, evil words. They were just considered contextually disgusting words.
And Eve Ensler, who's you know, made I was going to say a career, but it wasn't a careerist move. Who's really done wonders with the Vagina Monologues. It's played in, you know, thousands of places and dozens of countries around the world, has reclaimed the word vagina, for
absolutely
instance. And she does the introduction or a foreword to that book of yours.
She does. She actually wrote her first spoken word piece.
I noticed
in honor of that book.
Trying to get into that form.
It's sexy, I told you. But I actually directed the Vagina Monologues this summer for the first time, and I was kind of shocked at how I directed it at this women's music festival in Michigan, which is a very radical festival. It's very edgy, and Eve Ensler's work is still packed with punch and still incredibly meaningful. But I think because it's been done so often, it has lost some of that shock value, mm-hmm. which is I think was her intention, and that's a great thing.
Yeah, she succeeded, no doubt.
Yeah,
she tried to do slam poetry there, or spoken word, which was fun to see her stretch like that. You've been involved in the poetry slam or spoken word movement for more than a decade, certainly, and it still seems to be going strong. Why do you think it caught on and won't let go?
Next week, I'm the judge at the National Youth Poetry Slam, which has been happening for a couple of years. I think that is testimony to the fact that it speaks to such a wide range of ages. I think the youngest at the National Slam, the regular National Slam, was something like 8, and the oldest was 87 or something.
But does it really speak to an older crowd? I saw you perform when you were here in town several years ago,
uh-huh.
and it was mostly a middle-aged or even, I dare say, older than middle-aged crowd predominantly, and it took them a while to warm up to you, I thought, not because you weren't performing well. I thought you were doing a great job, but it just seemed like they weren't used to this kind of performance, this kind of art form, you know, the gestures and the intensity. Do you find that it's hard to reach over that age group, reach to that age group?
I think for better or for worse, corporate America has handed us a loaded gift with things like MTV Deaf Poetry Jam. And so it has sort of I think that it almost is like the cool thing to be into spoken word and slam poetry. You know, a decade ago when I would be flying somewhere to travel and people would ask me what I did for a living and I would sheepishly say I'm a slam poet, that sounded ridiculous to me. I'm sure my parents weren't thrilled either because they paid a lot of money for my education. But now no one ever second guesses what that means. In terms of the age difference, I don't know. I'm a firm anti-ageist, and I believe that kindness and warmth and valuable art and good politics transcend all that stuff.
And you did get to them ultimately, I have to say. I think you did a performance about women forebearers and that connected with them, and after you did that they came right on board. That was the rope you threw them, and
well,
they grabbed
on. I was going to say also that spoken word and slam poetry, I think as a genre, in some ways it's a very humble art form because it's really just you and a microphone and words that you've written and memorized, and that's very raw, and it's a humbling experience to perform like that because there's nothing flashy to compensate for the lack of, you know, the medium itself. On the other hand, there is a part to it that I think has this largesse and egoism that really needs to be avoided to communicate effectively. And I think for me, that's the difference between good and bad spoken word.
I'm speaking with Alex Olson, the spoken word artist. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. The neat thing, or one of the neat things about spoken word and this phenomenon that has caught on over the last 15, 20 years is the democratizing aspect of it, the democratizing pull of poetry into the public and out of the kind of asphyxiating confines of the academy. You write in the introduction, I think, to Word Warriors that poetry, say that 10 times, poetry was no longer owned by the publishers, academia, or the literary elite. Tell me about how liberating that is.
The whole conception, the whole idea of slam poetry in the very beginning was to take it out of those particular hands. And so, Mark Smith, who was a construction worker in Chicago, is the one who came up with this concept. Of course that's liberating. I mean, the first time I ever taught spoken word, I was in my early 20s. I was teaching 14 and 15-year-old LGBT homeless students from all the five boroughs of New York City. And together, I watched them express themselves for the first time with, they couldn't afford music lessons. These were homeless kids. And so there is something very refreshing about this idea that if you don't take advantage of it, which I'm very hard on my kids because I think that it's easy to say, oh, that rhymes with that, and I saw something that looked like that and sounded like that, I'm going to copy that. You know, that to me is not effective and authentic. But if you make them dig really hard, I think it's an incredible art tool and political vehicle.
You were put down at some poetry festival in Europe that you went to.
I was?
By some male poets who said, what you do isn't really poetry at all. It's more like theater. And I think the expression was, you should turn it down a notch.
Yes.
What was your response to that?
Well, I wrote him a poem, of course, Matt. Yeah, he told me that that poetry is supposed to be subtle. And that if I wanted to communicate more effectively as a feminist and an activist, I had to chill out and relax and tone it down a notch. And I wrote him a poem about the effectiveness of subtlety, and how some art is subtle and some art is really about politics.
I don't know that you can perform that on the air because of some of the words in that one. But is there a performance you could give us now, a spoken word performance, Alex Olson?
Sure, yeah. So this is about a big breakup that I suffered during the Bush administration years. But it starts out with an infatuation and a crush on my country. Dear Diary, I am so in love with my country. All for now. My country's taking me to a parade. Dear Diary, everywhere I turn, I hear people extolling the virtues of my country, telling me how lucky I am to be with her. I mean, even though I admire a lot of things about her, for example, she has a remarkable music collection, fascinating stories, and a real natural beauty, it's still starting to feel a little claustrophobic. Dear Diary, today I found out my country has been telling other people to tell me about how great she is. Don't you think that's kind of immature? I mean, I'd guess she was kind of insecure because she's a lot younger than a lot of other countries, but still, doesn't my country trust me to think for myself? Dear Diary, I'm getting a little worried about my relationship with my country. You see, as much as I want to love and support and nurture her, the one-way giving is starting to feel a little controlling. When I struggle to explain, for example, I need to feel celebrated, not just tolerated, she goes, But I get the distinct impression she's only pretending to listen. And I've noticed sometimes when she thinks I'm not looking, my country steals my checkbook and spends it on things like new combat boots for her and her friends, and then she lectures me about independence. Something doesn't feel right. Dear Diary, I asked my country today if she'll love me when I'm old and gray. She said as long as she doesn't have to go help me out or nothing. That hurt my feelings. I mean, I work hard to provide for my country. Heck, I even pay my country's bills. Dear Diary, today my country had a huge fight with her best friend, Church. Secretly, I was kind of glad because Church always looks at me weird like he wants to get in bed with my country. And secretly, I know he's dying to invade my body. So I suggested maybe they cool it off for a bit, you know, have a trial separation. My country looked at me as if I were crazy. She needs Church's support right now, she said. Whatever. I think Church should go get laid. Dear Diary, today my country and I had a huge fight when I was simply pointing out a virtue of another country. This, of course, segued into the topic of non-monogamy. So I finally felt the courage to point out that maybe I'm not the type to settle down with just one country. You know, just because I live with her doesn't mean I belong to her. At first, my country pleaded with me to stay, even dragging out flags as a reminder. But when I refused to back down, my country went ballistic. I mean, completely narcissistic, screaming that she's number one and that I'm a free-loving commie and that I've been flirting with Canada right in front of her face. I pointed out that she is always going around invading other countries' personal spaces and ultimately breaking their hearts. I learned my country does not enjoy hearing the truth told right up to her face like that. She completely shut down, cracked a beer, and turned on the news. The kind that only she likes to hear, these meaningless platitudes that massage her ego and justify her aggression. It's incessant. I feel powerless and frustrated. I want constructive discussions, me and her. But it seems like all my country is looking for is a cheerleader. Dear Diary, my country and I broke up today. It's almost like a hurricane swept through our relationship, rendering it seemingly irreparable. It seems for all my country's talk of core family values, she's completely unreliable, completely undependable, and I can't have a relationship with a country I don't trust. So me and some friends in January, we're planning on staging a critical intervention. Signing off for now. Grieving American citizen.
Wow, that's Alex Olson, spoken word artist, performing her poem, Dear Diary. And you're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine. And you can subscribe to the Progressive. I'd urge you to do so at progressive.org at our website, where you will also be able to hear this whole program in perpetuity. Let's talk a little bit about that subject, patriotism, because I'm asked about it a lot, and I usually say I'm not unpatriotic. I'm anti-patriotic because I don't like the concept of patriotism, period, and I think it's dangerous and can quickly transform itself into really malignant nationalism, and when you're as powerful a country as ours, that can be dangerous. And yet there's this pull and tug for people on the progressive side, whether you should reclaim the flag, whether you should say, you know, this is really what patriotism means, to protest and to speak out and reclaim the best of this country and not give the flag over to the right. And how do you come out on that?
Well, I think two things. One is that I believe that patriotism is an accident because, I mean, we're not responsible for where our mothers birth us. I mean, to me, that's sort of a joke. At the same time, obviously you are responsible for, once you're in a particular country, I think making it the best kind of policy, you know, especially in the United States, having the best policies possible because we're obviously interconnected, as a globe. But I think being a humanist is incredibly more important than being a patriot. I've always thought so. And it's more organic. It makes so much more sense. You know, I was a jock growing up.
What sports did you play?
Oh, I played soccer, and then in college I played rugby. And, you know, and I think that if you equate sort of patriotism with, you know, getting behind a sports team, and you see how kind of ridiculous it is when you see these, like, big, overweight, beer-drinking, beer-swilling guys on the sidelines that, you know, have attached themselves to this team. That's sort of how I feel sometimes about being a patriot. And in rugby, after whoever won or lost, we had a drink up and all told each other how great we were. I think that should be a model for the UN.
You know, it's funny because in sports, in organized sports now, they've become festivals of nationalism. I mean, the Super Bowl, you'll have the Fighting Jets fly over. What that has to do with scoring a touchdown, I don't know. But
right.
But there's something intertwined there that need not be and shouldn't be.
It's true. And if you look at the actual athletes who are sort of mercenaries, I mean, they're bought and sold depending on, you know, it's all a corporate installation, really. They're not attached to a particular city, you know. And if you look at, I think soldiers are trained to be the same way.
Yeah, there's a tie there. There also is, and we have a writer, sports writer, Dave Zirin, writing for The Progressive, who finds the beauty in athletics and in professional athletics, and salutes the athletes who dissent. Mm-hmm. And it's a rare athlete, but there are those out there who don't play that game and don't stand up for the national anthem and who are speaking out against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, even as we speak. So, you know, they're not all in one stripe, but the corporate media and the Pentagon certainly want us to think that sports and killing go together.
Right.
You've been doing some work. You've been going down to New Orleans. Tell me about that.
Yeah. There is a group in New York, and there are five of us from New York and five from New Orleans. Some of the women are Pamela Means, who's a singer-songwriter, Vicki Randall, who was Jay Leno's band leader. And so we take turns going to New Orleans and New York and coming up with an amalgamation of poems and songs. And we spent time in New Orleans interviewing a bunch of nonprofit folks who were just doing great work and rebuilding New Orleans. And so I came back and we all wrote poems about our experiences there.
What is Jay Leno's band leader like?
Oh, she's I don't know if I can say that word, actually. She's a good, bad, she's vigilant about her politics.
And so you wrote a poem or when you were down there, when you got back. Do you want to recite it for us?
Yeah, sure. It's called Box Spring in New Orleans. Poor Statue of Liberty, stuck in all that water. Her head must have drooped in shame when she heard her president proclaim that people in this part of the world are suffering, and this part of the world used to be her America. Well, I remember the bridge, the body, the barge, the body, the boat, the body, the breach, the body, the school bus, the scream, the stench, the water, the window, the water, the waiting, the water, the crash, the crush, the coast, the crime. I remember the explosion, the decapitated dog on the post, the dolphin in the pool, the crocodile, the cow, the bloat, the drown. Now, I remember 7 days of wait on a roof, 7 days of rape on a roof, 7 days of prey on a roof, and the helicopter, and how it never came. How they called it catastrophe, calamity, chaos. But the police gun-pointing our bus seemed organized enough. I remember the prisoners, who were people, in wheelchairs, in handcuffs, in the basement, and wondering how long. I remember the convention center, the Superdome, pissing on the floor of our new home. I remember the Fisher, the Desire, B.W. Cooper, Jefferson Parish, but mostly I remember balancing my baby on a box spring and sending her towards goodbye. I am now cold lunches, the National Guard, charter schools, subcontractors, detention centers, insurance adjusters, Blackwater, formaldehyde, FEMA, trailers in rows like tombstones, toxic, graveyards, demolition, bulldozers, Donald Trump, decaying lots, disintegration, closed daycares and clinics, commissions, E. coli, conflictions, condominiums, corporations, well-connected elections, voodoo tunes, jazz gumbo blues, and I am wondering, Red Cross, where the money went. Because I am now no playground, no recess, black children, criminal trespass, no gangs, no loiter. Because I am now a 10-year-old daughter with a sign, missing parents plus two brothers, I am now searching through the rubble for my grandmother. I am now your poems, your pictures, your politics, your thesis, your CNN segment, your cause, your conspiracy, your songs, your sympathy. But I am still in Baton Rouge, in Houston, Salt Lake City, Little Rock, in Denver, in Dallas, holding a sign in desperate need of assistance. I am still a refugee in my own damn country, and I am waiting for America to get my ass home.
That's Alex Olson, spoken word artist, doing a performance of Box Springs in New Orleans. What is New Orleans like now?
Well, that was 2 years ago when I was there, so I'm not sure what the progress has been. It was obviously heartbreaking, you know, for people who have connections to New Orleans like I did. But it was also, in some ways, I've always been a very radical atheist. And that flipped for me. I mean, I still am an atheist, but the beauty and the bounty of generosity that people came from in a religious and Christian way was actually kind of mind-blowing. That was one of the things I really took away.
So have you become less militant in your atheism?
Oh, yes. Gosh, I've been told that happens when you get older.
But you're not becoming conservative in your politics.
God, I hope not.
Me too, for your sake and mine. And I don't want to get more conservative either. It's crazy. There's still this culture war going on in this country. We had recently the murder of the doctor who was providing abortions, Dr. George Tiller. What was your reaction when that happened?
Um, Well, I think that my ultimate feeling was that it's an anomaly. I do think that there is a culture war, but I think so many people are so angry and are actually joining the ranks of people who care about humanity. So I feel very optimistic. It was a tragic loss, but I don't think that represents the fabric.
So you're optimistic. Why?
Because you have to be. There's no point otherwise.
There also has been tremendous gains and a lot of issues that you are connected with in the feminist movement and LGBT movement over time. These are also, and I think some people forget about this, these were really nonviolent revolutions in this country.
Yeah.
They weren't declared, you know, they weren't declared over either. They're not over. But if you look over the last, I've been looking over the last 100 years because the progressive's 100 years old, and you
right.
see the gains that were made. The progressive started before women had the right to vote. And then we had an interview with Harry Hay, one of the founders of the gay rights movement, who said when he realized he was homosexual, he tried to look up the word in the dictionary and he couldn't even find it.
Wow.
and so, you know, that kind of set me back, but it also impressed me. You know, people say, well, nothing has changed over the last 100 years. A lot's changed.
Right.
So maybe the look over history is what makes you optimistic other than just some character trait.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say also, and I think I mentioned this last time, but something that Howard Zinn once said to me that I found very profound was his idea that indie arts and indie political people, of which he is clearly not indie anymore. He's a huge name. But the idea that if you travel with a message around the country or around the world, you know, and you basically are grassroots media. And I think in some ways spoken word did that for the last decade. You know, there were so many of us just traipsing around kind of haphazardly, making this whole cultural art form up as we went along, never really calling it a revolution because that felt too grandiose. But looking back on it, to me, it does feel like it was a revolution, small r, you know. And I think because of places like the Progressive Radio, you know, and magazines like the Progressive, in some ways we just organically, because we care about people and that's our focus, we've all really helped each other. And it's a lovely thing to think about and look back on. And I think that's part of why I'm an optimist too, because the best people I've met are activists who know how to organically work together.
Well, thank you. And the non-corporate media, the non-corporate cultural scene, which
yeah.
you've been so much a part of, and other people like Ani DiFranco come to mind. They've been so much a part of that and has reached millions of people underneath the radar, beneath the radar, that no one really, you know, who runs the big corporate media recognizes in any way.
Right. Now they're being forced to. It kind of snuck up on them.
And yet it's happened. Now, you said before that you performed 200 places 200 times last year. Do you ever get tired of that?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I didn't get tired of the performances or even the traveling, but I think it took a collective toll.
And so how do you regroup?
I watch reality TV. No, just kidding. you know, I actually get refueled by watching other people do it and realizing how much I love to watch performances. And so if I can give that back, then I'm really lucky.
And when you're up on stage, that must be invigorating as well.
Yeah, I lose myself. I love it.
Well, Alex Olson, it's been great to talk with you again on Progressive Radio here. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks, Matt.
That's Alex Olson, A-L-I-X Olson, and you can find all about her on the web. And please, if you can, subscribe to The Progressive at progressive.org.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.